From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Here and Now is a production of PRI and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, Public Radio's daily podcast of news and culture. Pope Benedict XVI spoke again today about his comments last week that so enraged some Muslims around the world and led to threats against his life. The Pope did not apologize today, but acknowledged that his remarks were open to misunderstanding and insisted that he had deep respect for Islam and that he did not endorse a negative view of that faith, which worships one God. The Pope had quoted a Byzantine emperor who'd asked, "Show me just what Muhammad brought that was new, and there you will find things only evil and inhuman." Well, this global war of words takes place as Americans increasingly are confronted with people of other faiths. According to Harvard University's Pluralism Project, there are more faiths in the U.S. than in any other time in U.S. history. In fact, more faiths in America than in any other country. Diana Eck is professor of comparative religion and Indian studies at Harvard University, and she joins us now. And before we turn to the U.S., I'd like to ask you about the Pope's comments and his statement last week. What did you make of it, and why do you think it misfired so badly?
I mean, I'm an academic. I've read the speech. It is a speech that basically deals with reason and faith and the university, making a case for the inclusion of theology in the faculties of the university as a reasonable thing.
Because
why did he use this example?
Yeah, because the Byzantine emperor that he quotes was in an ongoing dialogue with a Persian cleric.
Yes, and what he gives us is only one side of that dialogue, alas, and we would like to hear more of what the Persian intellectual had to say, especially in response to the words that the Pope quoted, show me in the teachings of Muhammad the things that he would like to see.
Show me something more than the violence spread through the sword.
And what we have in the Pope's speech really is using this, as he said, a jumping off place for a larger discussion that says, you know, violence is not really compatible with what we know of the nature of God. Mm. And of course, we could take that argument and make it perfectly reasonably with reference to the terrible violence committed in the name of Christianity or in the name of Judaism or the violence contained in the Hebrew Bible.
That raises a question. We want to turn the focus back here to the U.S. as your project does. Why hasn't there been more unrest here? Because, as you tell us, there are now more Muslims in the U.S. than Episcopalians?
Oh, by a long shot, more Muslims than Episcopalians. The critical question is, are there more Muslims than Jews? I think so. Most people say around 6 million or something of the sort.
Well, that begs the question, given the violence around the world between people of different faiths, why isn't there more violence in this country? Now, we know there's been an increase in attacks on Muslims, according to a recent report. And we also know that post-9/11, there were terrible incidents, including a homicide. But still, why isn't there more violence here?
Well, that's a very important question. The Pluralism Project has actually tracked over the last 15 years many incidents of violence, harassment, and hate crimes that have focused on individual Muslims and on the Muslim community, from the vandalism and arson attacks on mosques to individual attacks on Muslims and also, by the way, on Sikhs and other people among the immigrant communities. But I think one of the things that has happened in the United States is the awareness among these groups that the United States is a place where if you report these things and if you take action to make them public, there is recourse. There is freedom of religious practice in this country, and one can weigh in with lawmakers and with courts as Muslims or as Sikhs or as Hindus in ways that may not have been possible in the countries from which they came. When things do happen, there is very often a kind of community response to them. I was reading a piece in the Salt Lake City paper this last week, because the Pluralism Project tracks both the good and the bad, you might say, mm-hmm. in our religious diversity news. But There was a report of an incident that happened, the only hate crime, really, in Salt Lake City post 9/11. A restaurant called Curry in a Hurry was attacked by a guy. And it was one guy, just like there was one guy who shot Balbir Singh Sodhi and killed him dead in Mesa, Arizona.
He was the gas station attendant, the Sikh.
The gas station, the Sikh.
Planting flowers.
And so we hear about these incidents. Of course we hear about them. We don't always hear about the next chapter. We don't hear about the 10,000 people who wrote to the family of that Sikh and offered their condolences on behalf of themselves in their religious communities. We don't hear about the tremendous responses in Salt Lake City to this one incident of violence. And that's an important thing to remember. I mean, for many, many years, John Paul II and other religious leaders have had very positive and creative things to say and bridges to build with Muslim communities. Those are not necessarily in the head of the news at night. Mm-hmm. But when something happens that is really destructive and dangerous, or that is as unsettling as the comments of the Pope again this last week, we do hear about it in the news.
And your report offsets that with some of the things people are doing to reach out to other faiths. I love the story of a Christian radio station that helped out. Was it a mosque?
It was a mosque in Toledo right after 9/11. In the evening of 9/11, they had rifle fire shot through the stained glass dome of the mosque. And immediately, the radio station broadcasted this incident and said, we have to do something about it. And now I read also this last week that that the Muslims who remember that in Toledo 5 years later recall the 1,500 people or more who came and circled the mosque with pledges of prayer and support and whatnot. And this Muslim leader in the Toledo mosque said, we here in this community will never forget that. Mm. Now, those are important things for us to know about what's happening in our world today. It's also important to know the other side, the disruptive, the things that, that fragment and tear at our social fabric. But we do need to know that all over this country, and in many ways all over the world, there are people of good faith, religious and otherwise, reaching out to try to build some bridges across the terrible chasm.
How does that square your findings about religious plurality with another interpretation of that phrase? I mean, by plurality, you mean in numbers, all these, you know, numbers of faiths. And the numbers are amazing. Montana, less than a million people in Montana, with 13 Buddhist sanghas, is that how you mm-hmm. say it? That's amazing. 10 different Buddhist sects. So that's one plurality, just the sheer number. But as you well know, for some, the phrase means acceptance of different faiths as equal paths to God. It sounds like you're seeing that as well.
Well, there are two ways of thinking about that, Robin. One is that diversity, plurality, is really just a fact of our life. And it is a fact of the world in which we live and of the countries, indeed the community in which we live here in Boston and elsewhere. What we do with that is the real question. And I interpret pluralism to mean a real engagement with that diversity, with that plurality. Now, I interpret that in one level as a citizen. But there's another piece to that, which is the religious. If I'm speaking as a Christian, which I am, it doesn't necessarily mean that one accepts that all religions are equally true or equally valid. We recognize the distinctiveness of our own and our own theological language. I think we're challenged.
We're speaking with Diana Eck of Harvard University about America in 2006, which her Pluralism Project reveals as the most diverse religious nation in human history. And just before the break, Diana, you were telling us about how we respond to the diversity of religions around us in two ways, as citizens, but also as believers. In other words, pluralism means technically there are a lot of faiths, but it also means for some people an acceptance of those faiths. And as you know, there are some who don't embrace the religious interpretation of plurality as an acceptance that all roads lead to God. They practice religious exclusivism, that the only path to God is through their God. Now, it's one thing to say the U.S. Constitution is very clear about freedom of religion and how citizens should react, but I wonder if you worry about the practical results here. You know, as the country becomes more diverse, will we see the violence we see elsewhere?
I worry about it in this country and elsewhere, that people are unable to somehow separate their theological views from our commitments as citizens. And I want to say again and again to my very, very conservative Christian brothers and sisters who think there's only one way of being religious in this world and who think that they can draw a circle around God and keep God inside of it somehow, I want to argue with them. And I want to argue with them on biblical bases. But if they want to argue on the basis of the Constitution, they've got a formidable task ahead. And either they have to rethink the whole nation, nature of the American nation, of our commitment to our principles, or maybe find somewhere else to live.
You know, you mentioned your Christian brothers and sisters, but obviously there are other fundamental wings of other faiths
sure,
that have the
are.
Same belief that there's only one path to God. But you do mention Christians, and we want to ask you to respond to Greg Easterbrook, who writes that you're recording the change in America's religious geography, if you will. Is the wrong story that if you had to choose one salient thing about U.S. spiritual culture, it wouldn't be the growth of plural forms, I'm quoting Greg, it would be the growth of committed Christians, and that growth comes not in conversions but in population growth, indicating immigration as well?
No, there's no question that the growth in Christianity in the United States is tremendous, including the changes in Christianity that have come with the new immigration, Christians from Africa and from Asia and indeed from all over Latin America. That is a story. Mm-hmm. But to say that that's the only story of what's happening here or the main one is really to miss the point. And no matter where we live in the world today, people of every faith have to come to grips with the multiple faiths with whom we share our nations and our world. And I think the issue of how to create really strong and vibrant multi-religious societies, that's our issue in the United States. But I tell you, that is the issue in England and France in different keys. That's the issue in India and Malaysia and Indonesia. And we need to be leading the way in that issue.
What are some of the things you've seen in the course of this project that even took you by surprise? I mean, I was surprised by how many different Buddhist sects there were in Montana, and I'm sure I'm going to hear from all of them. but what are some of the things that surprised you?
Well, I think one of the most amazing things to me is the incredible hospitality with which I and the researchers and colleagues I have all over the country have been received in their religious communities. And the fact that many people, even, you know, 40 years into this new way of living and being in America, are really not very well acquainted with the neighbors who are right across the street from them. And also the fact that these last 5 years, how hard they've been for both Muslim and Sikh communities in the U.S. I think this is something we need, just quite frankly, to recognize: the heightened suspicion, the sense of being under the microscope. 83% of the Sikhs in the United States have either personally experienced discrimination or know someone closely who did in these 5 years.
Sikhs, by the way, have a turban.
Wear the turban.
But mm-hmm. But their faith is what?
Their faith is a very strongly monotheistic and service-oriented faith based in India, beginning in the 16th century, very egalitarian. Men and women, people of all races and backgrounds, are welcome in the Sikh community. And a holy scripture that really includes the most beautiful poetry from all of North India, which they sing.
You mentioned the tough times in the past 5 years for especially the Muslim and Sikh community that have a garb that will point
something
out who they are.
Makes them visibly different.
Right. But as you well know, there have been voices very critical of American Muslim communities saying, why aren't we hearing more of you repudiating some of the violence we're seeing? And you write, they can't get their voice. They can't
get
out heard.
There. Can't get voices heard. And I hear this still. You know, 5 years hence, there are lots of moderate Muslims in the United States. There are lots of people who are articulating what they would call a progressive form of Islam, or really just articulating Islam itself as people who are grounded and in thinking in the modern world. And part of the difficulty is that the United States is not very welcoming of some of these voices. And I think particularly of the case of one of the most extraordinary Muslim thinkers in Europe, Tariq Ramadan, who's been excluded from the United States over the past two-plus years.
The Bush administration thinks that he has terrorist ties.
Well, that's apparently what the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of State had to say. They have until tomorrow either to issue him a visa or tell him why. But this is a perfect example. I mean, President Bush, in his speech at the United Nations, was talking about how we need to have moderate Muslim voices, and you Muslims all over the world need to speak up and articulate the peace that is within you, etc. We don't let a lot of these people into our own country. And I think that the message that we send is so confused when, you know, our borders are really closed to some of the best and the brightest of Muslim leaders.
Diana Eck, professor of comparative religion and Indian studies at Harvard University. She's been studying the transformation of America's religious life since 1991, when she founded the Pluralism Project at Harvard University. Diana, thank you so much.
A great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tune in weekdays at noon for live, up-to-the-minute news from around the world, and visit our website, here-now.org, for more on today's top stories. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.